If everyone could take their seat, please, and board members as well, thank you. Please take your seat. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seat so we can remain on schedule. Thank you very much. Our next speakers, you have a 30 minutes allocation. And that will be the Salinas River Channel Coalition, Salinas Valley Water Coalition, Monterey County Farm Bureau, and the Grower Shipper Association of Central California. And when you speak, if you can introduce yourself. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Board Chair and Board Members and State Board Member. Thank you for the opportunity to present before the lunch hour. I hope our rumbling stomachs won't distract us too much at this point. I am Norm Groot. I'm with Monterey County Farm Bureau, and I'm going to introduce our panelists to you. To my left is Wayne Gallardi with Rincon Farms. He's a landowner and farm operator in the Salinas Valley. Beyond it, that is Abby Taylor Silva, who is with the Grower Shipper Association of Central California. And to my right is David Costa of Costa Farms, also a landowner and farm operator within the valley here. Missing from our panel today is Nancy Isaacson with the Salinas Valley Water Coalition. She had a family emergency come up overnight and is unable to be here today. And so I'm going to be filling in for her. And we're going to talk directly from her remarks, which she sent to me this morning by email. So I'm going to speak to those at this point. So this is from Nancy, who is going to do our introduction on how did we get to where we're at this point. As far back as 1941, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and others identified flood control and protection in the Salinas Valley as essential. It was understood that projects that would be provided would increase channel capacity and protection against bank erosion where needed, and that such channel improvements and flood control from that water from storage would be needed to be managed in such a way as to reduce flood damages and provide protection. In other words, they realized early on that the necessity of having to maintain the channel capacity in order to provide flood protection and at the same time the need for storing water for conservation releases to assist with recharge of our groundwater basin and in efforts to stop seawater intrusion, but the management of the reservoirs provided extended time in which water could continue to flow through the Salinas River channel. These extended flows, while providing recharge, also provided for silt transportation and sandbar formation in some reaches while maintaining wet conditions that encouraged in-channel growth. This has resulted in an increase in non-native vegetation, increases in evapotranspiration by almost 20,000 acre feet per year from our estimates by the non-native vegetation, essentially creating a scenario that requires more stored water to be released in order to meet the recharge needs and stop seawater intrusion. The agricultural community recognizes that the rules and needs as to the environment and the landowners have changed over time. But the goal is the same, to maintain flood protection, which incorporates the need for channel maintenance. Historically, Monterey County Water Resource Agency has managed a channel maintenance program that allowed landowners and growers and others to do certain channel maintenance activities, in part to provide flood protection. In recent years, it has been difficult, if not impossible, for landowners and growers and others to do any kind of channel maintenance activities. This change occurred at the same time the Salinas Valley Water Project was implemented, which included the reservoirs being managed to provide year-round flows. another impediment to landowners and growers doing any channel maintenance activities. Water Resource Agency's Salinas River Stream Maintenance Program was an attempt to provide a process for channel maintenance activities. No one was happy with the draft or final EIR, and most felt it fell far short of achieving its stated goals. The agricultural organizations worked together to develop an alternative project, one that could be implemented in the short term and allowed for the completion of certain channel maintenance activities, while recognizing the need and requirement for a long-term program. Our short-term project focuses on deferred channel maintenance, invasive species control, and trash removal. As an interim step towards a longer-term approach to managing the river for multiple benefits, including flood risk protection, water recharge, and water quality improvement. We believe that together as a community, working with our resource agencies, we can adequately address the channel maintenance needs of the Salinas River and the flood and provide flood protection. So that concludes Nancy's remarks, and I apologize I had to read those because she sent them to me overnight. So now we're going to move into the Salinas River short-term channel sustainability proposal that was put together. And this was done by four organizations that are appearing before you today. And I'll say that it was not solely done by the organizations, that we had involvement from landowners and farm operators involved in this discussion and provided significant input into this. I do have hard copies of our proposal that we can distribute after our panel discussion is complete. So what are the mutual benefit goals of this proposal that we have come forth with? And we have provided this to the Water Resource Agency at their meeting on February 24th. It is obviously to achieve a flood risk reduction along all stretches of the river, and to increase the water recharge capabilities that we currently have lost because of excess vegetation in the stream bank and along the stream channel itself. We also want to look at improving bank stabilization and minimizing erosion. We also think that we can improve water quality by completing all these activities throughout the river channel. And the main focus here is to control the invasive species and indeed remove it, so that we can ensure channel flow capacity, and then by that, manage our habitat effectively. So the project area remains the same. It's from mile marker 2 to mile marker 94, the 92 miles that were discussed earlier by the Water Resource Agency. It includes constrained reaches as well as unconstrained reaches of the river. As mentioned before, it's all private property owned by the landowners and the farm operators. It includes municipal facilities. We have a number of water reclamation plants and other facilities, parks, for example, along the riverbank that need to be protected, and we want to include those municipalities in this discussion and our short-term project. So also to protect public infrastructure, such as bridges over the river at various different points, whether they be Caltrans or county facilities. The overview of the project includes that landowners will identify specific reaches of the river stream bed itself that they would like to use in this short-term project. In other words, what maintenance would they like to do on their property? Each landowner would then select a river channel activity and a year of work within the five-year scope of this particular project and manage that particular process as best he sees on his property and what really fulfills his needs at this point. Specific assessments of all the impacts fall within the EIR, in our opinion, and we feel that some modifications to the EIR to specifically include a short-term project are appropriate here. The Master 401 and 404 permits and certification would be held by the Water Resource Agency. As I stated, this would be a five-year project, and we would like to see it renewable in case that a long-term project is not completed or adapted. And we feel that some of this, or most of this, could actually be included in the long-term vision of what we see for the river as a maintenance unit or management. So the activities that we're talking about at this point are non-native vegetation removal and control of native vegetation. And I want to be very clear here that we are not talking about total vegetation removal. We are talking about a managed process here, focusing on the non-native removal. We also are looking at sediment management, stream bank stabilization and erosion control, and channel enhancement to improve capacity and flow, specifically targeting trash removal and other activities as landowners may identify that they feel are important to their particular stretch of the river. We're also looking for flexibility in this program. As we all know, this river changes course and it changes with each hydrologic event that happens here. We'll discuss this a little further in our presentation a little bit later. But I think we want to make sure that we can adapt from year to year and specifically target the activities that we need to do as we see how the river reacts during each rainy season, so to speak. And trash removal activities will vary from year to year depending on how much really ends up in the river channel itself. We feel this is a collaborative approach with all the other projects that are being proposed, including the RCDs project that you just heard about, as well as the Nature Conservancy and their pilot project between Gonzales and Soledad. The individual projects that landowners may want to come up and apply for their own permits should be included in this process also. The NRCS has an ongoing stream bank stabilization project for tributaries that could be utilized here. And, of course, our short-term channel sustainability project proposal. We feel these are all collaborative and can be useful in putting together a real, true short-term management plan as we work towards a long-term approach. So what we did in early February is we went out to a large majority of the landowners along the river as well as the farm operators and surveyed them real quick to see who would commit to doing work in the channel, and we got back very quickly 77 individual parcels that intend at this point to perform one or more activities in multiples of years. These range from mile marker 5 to mile marker 90, so it does encompass a large part of the channel. And the range of activities were as simple as a single activity such as removing trash each year to alternating activities in various years as well as the same activity in multiple years. And we want to further survey landowners to make sure that we're all inclusive and that everyone has a chance to express their intent to participate in this type of a program. So quickly, the benefits of a short-term project. Landowners are willing to complete these activities at their own expense. The master permits would be held by the Water Resource Agency. The impacts can be managed from year to year as we adapt the program or the project as we go forward. Non-native vegetation is prioritized. Areas of work are site-specific and can be modeled for flood risk potential. And certain mitigations, we feel, are no longer needed due to the short-term duration of this particular project. So with that, I will pass it over to Wayne.
Okay, hello all government officials and public attendees, and thank you for the opportunity for me to speak on this issue today. A farmer's perspective of the Salinas River stems from our knowledge of the history of the river. We and other ag leaders and the Corps and the state, years ago, we were the ones that had the foresight and the ingenuity to tame this once wild river, wild as it was, to everyone's benefit. When we constructed the dam starting in 1957. But now for the past 5 years, by not allowing us our continued channel maintenance permit, we're being denied the key link needed for flood control, for groundwater recharge, erosion controls, better water quality, and better steelhead and wildlife habitat. It's documented that in 1769, the Salinas River was called the Chocolate River by Spanish Army explorers because of the murky waters it would carry, obviously from soils it had eroded from upstream. Then the first severe floods were reported at the Soledad Mission in 1824, and several more floods were reported there the years following. By the 20th century, several accounts of this wild river taking away large areas of land alongside it had been noted. So we love to talk the words historical and natural state of the river because we need to take a closer look at that. The earliest overhead photos that I could find are from 1937. Here we see an area in late October 1937 near the Gonzales River Road Bridge. and that bridge is right there. And note the areas of land that were farmed from this same area. And we could see the areas farmed along the river. Take a good look at this area here that was farmed and the area here that was farmed. If we look at that again in 1956, there's the bridge, that area that was farmed before. The river took it all away. The areas up in here, the river took it all away. So before and after. This was, you know, 1956. This was the last year before the dam was built. And we can see that those were 50-acre areas of farmland. I calculated it out to about 50 acres of area just in this one spot following a very wet 1955 to 56 winter. Interesting to notice here that this river, this 1956 photo, this August 1956 photo, the river is dry. More on that subject later. Here in this next slide, I notice a lot of people like looking at this. Okay, the Chular region, from Gonzales to Chular, we notice that there's quite a bit of wild activity going on with the river here too. And if we pinpoint a 100-acre spot, okay, there's a 100-acre spot right in there. You look at the next photo, 1956, that had disappeared. Their neighbor, Pete Pedrazzi, he told me that from the 1941 flood, that's when that happened. And he remembered when poor Mr. Martin had to go out to work on that particular 1941 notice morning. He noticed that he lost 100 acres all in one night, and unfortunately, he had to give up the farm because the river washed away his investment. So here we were, you know, putting in thousands of hours of sweat, energy, blood, money, you name it, to develop these lands for farming with irrigation systems and all, only to watch in despair as thousands of tons of soil could and would wash all away to the ocean, sometimes only a few years later. What the river bringeth, the river taketh away, became the saying. So if anyone tries to convince you that we are farming too much in the floodplain, they are missing the point. The photos show that a lot of farmland and riparian land got washed away. Even before these lands were farmed, the earliest explorers and settlers told us that this river had these destructive patterns from time to time. So please note the 1956 photos. This was the last year of the wild Salinas River, and how much less riparian areas there were in those areas. You know, this right here. You see, the river was so wild it would take those riparian areas away, as compared to what they were before. So again, our construction of the dams resulted into a dramatic improvement for wildlife and steelhead habitat. Note this modern day photo. The banks in the channel it's because we created this constant, actually unnatural, controlled water flow for almost all year, practically every year, since 1957, allowing for this overgrowth, again, creating a much better environment for steelhead and water quality than this photo. Okay, and we paid for this with our tax dollars. So now we farmers have this horrible feeling of remorse that some of the regulatory agencies are overstepping their boundaries, it seems, taking excess advantage of what we created, trying to get excess benefit for ESA or whatever else without letting us get our end of the deal. It's as if all those benefits we created still isn't good enough for a few special interests. Do we want to go back then and tear the dams down? Is the eroding away of hundreds of acres of farmland and riparian land a good idea for water quality or for the National Marine Sanctuary? Is that a better condition for wildlife and steelhead? No. According to the definition of ideal conditions for steelhead, we want to keep the reservoir operations practices. But we have to have a channel maintenance program to control this unnatural growth of vegetation and oversiltation to help meet with requirements for the ResOps program and for the Salinas Valley Water Project and the rubber dam. Some of us consider it a taking of our property if we are not allowed to have a reasonable channel maintenance program in order to keep the river flowing freely in its designed designated course and we can still have secondary channels for the fish. So we need a long-term vision, not just a year-by-year vision. The Salinas River Channel Coalition actually had a scientific study done by the environmental engineering firm Entrix, submitted to the county and state at public hearings in 2008, stating that a channel maintenance program helps water recharge, reduces flow restrictions, helps for reducing flood erosion, and overall does not impair water quality. When the floods occur, they tear and erode topsoils away, and they even destroy some farm worker homes. In effect, the flooding takes away a lot of people's jobs. Do flood events still occur with a channel maintenance program? Yes. But are the floods as destructive compared to not having a channel maintenance program? No. So I've already explained all the benefits of the Nacimiento and the San Antonio and how we already did our task to benefit the people of California and much wildlife years ago. But to keep these benefits, we need to maintain a cleared river channel, ideally something like we had here just back in 2007 when we still had the permits, allowing as free a flow of water as possible to help reduce flood spikes. And with secondary channels, which there are some in there, with allowing for small pools for fish to rest. In conclusion, it could be said that it is negligent to stop our channel maintenance program because without it, the people of the state are no longer getting benefit of the improved water quality, safer wildlife habitat, better chance for survival of endangered species, flood control, soil erosion risk control, and groundwater recharge. I therefore urge everyone involved to give us the channel maintenance program back like we most recently had it. Thank you.
And Mrs. Taylor, you have about 10 minutes.
Wonderful, thank you. So Abby Taylor-Silva with the Grower Shipper Association, and sitting with me is David Costa of Costa Farms, and he and I are going to share this presentation in our last 10 minutes. So the project and the process that Norm spoke about, I want to give you my kind of my simple way of looking at the EIR and the projects that go with it. To me, the EIR is a very large umbrella under which sits a home that is the project. Within the home are a number of rooms, and within those rooms are all components of the project. So one of those rooms at this time could be the river management units that are being organized by the Nature Conservancy. Another could be a number of growers coming together to get their own permit. And another could be this project that Norm and I are speaking to you about. So they would all work together within that one big project under that EIR. And that's the easiest way for me to think about it, and I wanted to share that with you. So within the process for moving that project along, there will each project area must first go through a site screening process. And with that, we'll determine the eligibility to perform work in each of those areas. And within the site screening, we would include biological assessments, wetland delineations, and an understanding of current conditions. So we'd start with a basic description of the project and all the different options for river maintenance. And Norm already spoke to those. Those include vegetation, sediment management, trash removal, and others. From there, Monterey County Water Resources would work with growers and operators to determine their eligibility within the EIR. Protocols for work, and those might include tree removal based upon the diameter of the trees, bypass channels for fish, and others would then be developed and followed. From there, operators and landowners would prepare their applications for their 1,600 permits with Fish and Wildlife, and Fish and Wildlife would look to approve with consultation of all appropriate resource agencies, including the Monterey County Water Resources. All of this would be done in parallel to the work being done with the regional board to receive certification of the 401 permit and with NOAA to get authorization on the 404 permit. The flood conditions would be modeled by Monterey County Water Resources Agency using appropriate historical and current data for the proposed project areas. As Mr. Chartavoin mentioned, Monterey County Water Resources 2 weeks ago allocated $150,000 to update their current EIR so that it more fully covers the projects that we've been talking about over the last few months. Our organization was one of those that asked them to wait to certify until they did so, and they are moving forward to doing so, which we're very appreciative of. We hope that there will be resources within that to also assist within the modeling effort. And part of what we hope to learn from Monterey County Water Resources will be an assessment of what is needed to model effectively. The baseline vegetation conditions would also be mapped, and these would be done using the Monterey County Water Resources draft EIR, which would then be the final certified EIR, and species data from Fish and Wildlife and any other appropriate sources. The Fish and Wildlife has a mapping of endangered species. This includes the red-legged frog, birds, etc., and that informs landowners and operators of which classes or courses they need to take in order to manage the river in different situations and in different sections. Historically, my members and the growers have taken courses to understand how to manage for these endangered species, and that is what Dave will speak to now.
Thanks, Abby. Annually, as participants in a channel maintenance process, we were required to attend a two-hour class, and each year that we participated in a permit, we were required to revisit that two-hour class and receive training on the red-legged frog's behavior, its habitat, its sensitivity to human activities, and project measures to be implemented. We were required to notify immediately the water agency or an approved qualified biologist if we observed a red-legged frog in the project area during work. Work was to stop, and the biologist was required to move the frog away from the project site. Additional red-legged frog provisions included no work zones of between 17 and 33 feet from potential habitat, depending on the month of work, because those requirements changed when you went from October 31st to November 1st, if the river was still dry and you were allowed to work in the channel based on the permit, and the habitat conditions would dictate that. But we were required also to mark a 10-foot buffer zone off the low flow channel prior to the beginning of any work, and very specifically our direction was to use 4-foot stakes and blue flagging. That was spelled out as one of our permit conditions, and there was no native vegetation removal allowed within that buffer zone. We were required to enlist the services of a qualified biologist to assess our site, as I recall, for the potential habitat for the least bells vireo and red-legged frog, again, before approval of our permit would occur. We had a total of 21 permit conditions on our last channel maintenance permit.
We wanted to note that the proposed areas of the project would change very likely annually as the river conditions change. And landowners are also determining the area of the channel that they propose to perform maintenance activities in. The reason for that annual change, I think predominantly in being prepared for that, is due to trash removal. We don't always know what trash will be. I think we saw a photograph earlier noting that the photograph taken maybe not even a year or two ago, now there are diapers and things in there. So you can't control what trash will be placed in the river. I think it's important that we recognize that the growers, as they filled out the intent forms with our organizations a couple of weeks ago, really thoughtfully thought about what kind of work they're going to need to do. They're not saying that they need to do sediment management or vegetative management, native or non-native, every single year. And Dave's going to speak a little bit to the thought process he went through in noting what he needed.
I think on my process, it was obvious that there were a few basic things that needed to occur, you know, every year. And I thought that in a 5-year proposal that we would have trash removal every year and sediment management with regards to sandbars and any allowed work that we could have as they were developing. But I think that myself, for our operation, that native and non-native vegetation was a little bit more of an intermittent requirement in alternate years, or I estimated it to be in 3 out of the 5 years. of that permit. I mean, and among the things with regards to trash removal, it's been all things related to illegal dumping and movement downstream of the remnants of illegal dumping. Cars, like the chairman shared, stolen cars, abandoned cars, tires, truck tires, couches, TVs, refrigerators. The list gets long. Probably the other point I'd like to make, too, is that every project does not require a bulldozer. And in the last 2 years of our work in the River Channel, we spent substantially more money on permits and engineering and consultants than we did actually working in the channel. And the work that we did in the channel involved a mower and a day or a day and a half of work, and we were allowed to disc a mowed area in specific alternate years in the last years of our permit. But the point is, not everything involves big equipment.
So the maintenance area map, I think that this is probably of huge importance to the regional board, because in your May letter on the EIR, you, I think, were expressed concern about not having an exact idea of exactly where work would be performed. And that's something that we've tried to address in our work with growers, and to the point that Dave just made in asking what river miles you're going to be planning to work in and what activity you'd like to do. So we hope that we've addressed that, and that's something that, of course, is going to go into the modeling and to the discussions and the decisions on the certifications of the permits and with Monterey County Water Resources. Finally, there's been a lot of talk about the monitoring and the need for monitoring. You know, to my knowledge, there's not another privately held river channel of this size in the United States, much less California. And so I think that modeling is very important. And it's going to provide a basis for, one, a transparent process that provides protocols to the public for assessing benefit. It's also going to help landowners and operators better understand the system they are managing. And I think it will influence future projects as we're talking about the long term. It's important that we all be adaptive as the river changes. To Wayne's point, you've seen these photographs in just 20 years, how the river can change. We really need a baseline of understanding to understand river management benefit. And I think that goes towards not just recharge. You've heard of the tens of thousands of acre feet lost every year right now to the vegetation pulling it out. We are in a drought. That's very important recharge, not only to the growers, but to those drawing groundwater. Without the recharge, you're going to see higher levels of other constituents. And it's also going to be important to many factors. But I'll let Dave speak a little bit about why that's important to him.
Well, I think as a grower, myself and others really want science to drive the management of this river channel. And I don't think anybody has any interest in spending money if there's no determined benefit. And the analysis of the results of channel work are really important. I think, you know, the benefits of channel maintenance extend beyond what I see in my family's operation with regards to loss of topsoil or crops that are lost due to their death from flooding or the inability to plant or harvest due to food safety concerns or requirements. But, you know, the benefit extends to the community as a whole, and I want to make sure that that's not lost with regards to roads, bridges, wastewater treatment plants. I know at least four that were inundated in 1995, homes and emergency services.
So finally, I think that we've found, you know, just a few weeks ago, the Nature Conservancy came to our stakeholder group and brought together kind of a list of priority process points. And we really felt that that list made a lot of sense. And to be honest, what I've just presented you in large part is based on that list. I think that that stakeholder group that's been put together by Monterey County Water Resources has been very productive. And, you know, we at Grower Shipper, and I think I speak for my partners here as well, we're really focused on finding common language, clarifying, and I think there are a lot of areas of agreement. And there's a lot of good to be had from this EIR and to work within it. And we appreciate all the work that's being done by Monterey County Water Resources right now to help us find a final solution. And to you as well for holding this workshop and allowing us to present to you and answer your questions. Dave?
And if you can wrap up.
Okay, no, and I will. I think that we're trying to do our part as growers, as property owners in and along the river. We're trying to work with and protect habitat, and I think that we're trying to find a way to coexist with that habitat some way, somehow, in a mutually beneficial way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, in order to alleviate the concerns of our emeritus chair here, Mr. Young, I will start this time on my right. But before I do that, I would like to remind all of us that the purpose of this workshop today is very much to be the listeners and hear what our speakers have to say. And also, very importantly, we have speaker cards. We're very interested to hear what the public has to say. And then wrapping up with a very meaningful conversation about the next steps. So with that in mind, Mr. Moore.
No, I don't have any questions. Thank you for the presentation. Really appreciate it.
Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Abby, I appreciate your story on a house with all the rooms in it. I guess my question to that or my concern or question to that would be that every response I've seen from a permitting agency or even a stakeholder group with an environmental alignment has really just almost damned the EIR and the modeling, the science behind, or the lack of science behind it, what they're calling the poor modeling, the lack of mitigation. And so you're building this house for your project, and you're putting that EIR on the roof and then saying you'll have these components under there. How are you going to reconcile that given what's been seen so far in responses?
Not to speak for the agency, but if from the outside looking in, I think that was really the point of the stakeholder group, right? It was to bring those different, all those people who spoke in September and a lot of the people who wrote letters, and let's talk about what's needed. And I think a lot of good has come out of that. I think that the decision by Monterey County Water Resources 2 weeks ago to allocate that $150,000 is meant to do just what you're saying, and that's meant to fix anything in the EIR that should be fixed based on those comments passed. I mean, I think a lot of the administrative record that you're seeing is based on the draft EIR that we had in the early fall.
Okay.
And I think a lot's being done. I think
you can certify bad. Well, you can certify what somebody calls a bad EIR. It doesn't matter. That could just be what side of the aisle you're sitting on, too.
Right.
But the real need is going to be for your stakeholder groups, if I can call them your, to address the permitting agencies' concerns. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, this board, we can look at what we consider a good EIR or a bad EIR and not care at all. We still have to meet other requirements to issue a permit. So how do you see all that moving forward?
Well, I think that, to Assemblymember Alejo's point about kind of looking at how we can put resources towards making this a strong modeling project, a really strong model. I think, all of us up here agree that you need a strong model. And I think we also need to really be benchmarking data and information. I think that moving forward, it's going to be very critical that Monterey County Water Resources has what they need in the EIR, right? And that's what they're working on right now. In order to have a strong model. I think we're going to be educated about what a strong model will look like as the next few weeks and month go on. And then I think it's going to be very critical that we all be working with the resource agencies to move the process forward and be having some strong and productive dialogue. And that's where I come to, understanding, I think sometimes we're speaking almost different languages,
Yep.
And I think that we need to, and I think that on behalf of my members, I know Grower Shipper is very willing to come forward and say, okay, where are we getting stumbled here? And let's work past it. So,
and I'll, just case in point, I'll give you an example and you can clear that up for me, but I heard Mr. Groot say that a landowner could identify what they want to do. It can be modeled for flood potential, but I would hear you say that we're going to model for flood potential as part of the project, right?
Right.
And that's what you would really mean, right?
Absolutely.
That's
okay.
Correct.
That's
we,
okay. Then.
We do intend to model for flood protection.
Okay, perfect.
Did not mean to construe that it was optional.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Mayor Delgado.
Thank you, Chair. Norm, can you give me an example of a landowner project that would be allowed with your short-term proposal, and another example of a landowner project that wouldn't be allowed under your short-term proposal?
For instance, we have one landowner who has intent to do trash removal in 5 years consecutively during the term of this particular proposal. We would suggest that there is no impacts from trash removal. In fact, that's a benefit for the environment. So we would see that as easily permittable. Other impacts that probably would not be permittable under the EIR would be a wholesale clearing of all vegetation from the low flow channel itself.
Okay. Abby, when you foresee this process of going through an EIR and getting the permits and then turning it over to landowners, in that process, who determines if a specific landowner's proposed project is appropriate or not?
From what I understand, based on the model, Monterey County Water Resources would come back and say, your project fits in the model for this and perhaps not for this. So for instance, perhaps a grower comes and says, I want to do native vegetation management all 5 years. The Monterey County Water Resources could come back and say, you know, it's not going to fit within the model for you to do it. You can do it every other year or something like that. And then it would be incumbent on that operator or landowner to go to Fish and Game to work out further details in their 1600 permit, which then would be done in cooperation with Monterey County Water Resources.
All right, thank you. Wayne, that 2008 NTREC study, is that something that's available for the rest of us to look at?
Yes, it is. As I said, it was presented to public hearings both at the Monterey County Water Resources Agency and state public hearings, and the Water Resources Agency here at Monterey County does have copy.
All right, I'll ask them. Thank you very much, Wayne. And you did a great job, for me anyway, giving me your perspective.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask, Abby, you mentioned about modeling with existing information. Do you have any opinion about the 1D versus the 2D? The Nature Conservancy seemed to prefer one or the other. How about you?
Well, I mean, I think that we need to look at all options. I really commend the Nature Conservancy for all the work they've done and the resources they've expended in order to have that 2D model. I think we need to look at, again, looking at where we can get resources so that we can make the best model possible. And, I mean, I'm very appreciative that we have that on the certain reaches of the river. And I think that that's really where we're going to look to Monterey County Water Resources to help us understand what's needed.
Does it bother you that the 1D model has those sharp lines and it doesn't seem in all cases to predict backflow or actual flooding that would likely occur?
I don't know if it bothers me, but I do think that I just think there's a lot that goes into the total discussion, you know? And so to me, I mean, I think that we have to balance getting as comprehensive information as possible in the modeling with what it's going to cost and where the cost and the payment is coming from. And I know Assemblymember Alejo is looking at how he can help us in that regard. But I think speaking for my members, they want the best information possible, but we need to figure out how that will be funded.
And probably to move quickly, consider the timeliness of it all.
Yeah. Thank you, Mayor.
I had one last question for David. You mentioned there was, I think, four wastewater treatment facilities damaged in 1995. Do you agree with what we heard earlier that 1995, like flood damage, is not something that's within our human ability to do much about?
I agree with that. Generally, where I come from is just, you know, trying to not lose sight of the depth and the velocity and the duration of flooding, but I use that as an example. For example, how the peninsula was disconnected from access to Highway 101 for, you know, a day and a half or something during that stretch, and I would suspect that some level of that still would have happened in a lesser flood. But in 95, Highway 1 was closed at Twin Bridge. It was underwater. Highway 1 South was closed at Big Sur with the landslide. The Chular Bridge approach was washed out. Highway 68 was underwater. The Gonzales Bridge approach was washed out. And the only way from the peninsula side of the Salinas River to Highway 101 was the old Arroyo Seco Road Bridge at Soledad or the one-lane green bridge at Elm Avenue in Greenfield?
I would love to add to the answer to that question. It is, we did not have a channel maintenance program preceding the year 1995 for about 10 years. So would the effects of 1995 flood been better, or how should I say, not as bad? If we had a channel maintenance program, I would say yes to that question.
Thank you. I'd like to keep things moving because I'm targeting 1 o'clock for lunch. So in order to try to stay on schedule and be respectful to the rest of the speakers. So having said that, Mr. Jeffrey.
I think you said that just for me, purposely.
Oh, it wouldn't even cross my mind.
I'm just kidding, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the panelists. I thought you put everything together. Wayne, I want to thank you for the field trip that some of us went on last fall. Your demonstration, amount of topsoil that you lost during that period of time. And also with that topsoil loss, the backflow, the flooding for that particular area. And looking at some of the non-native species that are in the river in that particular location at Gonzales and the Chular Bridge is really an eye-opener if you actually visually see it. I think boots on the ground is important. And talking about the 95 flood, and somebody alluded to that, Monterey Peninsula was isolated. I happen to be the chair of the Monterey County Red Cross, and you don't think I wasn't a very busy person because Monterey was isolated. There was no way to get anything in there other than by helicopter or by air, and it was very difficult to take care of some of those folks that were flooded out of their homes in those particular locations. So I think that, and I applaud your organizations for stepping up and trying to put all this together. My question to you is, do you have any landowners along the river that are opposing what you're trying to do?
No, I mean, I think that it's important to remember that this is a privately held a river channel.
Well, that's my question. It's privately held.
Right.
And it seems like if everybody is not coordinating with this or participating, if you have one landowner upstream and one in the middle that's not going to do anything, then it's going to make it very difficult to make it all work.
Right, and that is something inherent to this. I mean, being that it's privately held, exactly. I mean, it's everyone's choice. And as has been stated before, this is a very expensive endeavor, especially in certain areas. I know that I have members that have done work for their neighbors when, allowed. And I envision that could very well happen again. But, I would say there aren't people that are unhappy that there's an option on the table. But that does not mean that they will participate. And again, it's their private property. But I do think you have, as Norm indicated, a lot of people who are interested and have the resources.
I would hope everybody's interested because it would be beneficial to all of them. And I know you're so persuasive that if anybody gets out of line, you're going to bring them in.
You got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Quickly.
Dr. Hunter.
I just, in the interest of time, I want to respect the fact we've got more speakers to come, but I do appreciate and I have had a chance to speak with Mr. Costa. I appreciate the tours that we've gone on, and so I think you understand we are very appreciative of having another opportunity to hear from you and to understand how the plans are moving forward. I think there are a lot of hurdles ahead, but it sounds like there are a lot of possibilities for pushing on through. So that's what we all want.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Mr. Johnson?
I have two questions, and for the second question, I'd like to just put up a slide that was late in Mr. Galarte's presentation of the 2012 was it aerial photo 2012 river conditions. My first question is, you talked about a number of of people who saw their participation as being simply trash removal. And do you need a permit? Does a landowner need a permit to remove trash from the river?
Yeah, that's a good question, but apparently to be able to go in and do any type of work, we do need some type of permit. Abby's nodding yes.
So even if it's just to pick up trash?
Yeah, that's someone else dumped, yeah.
It's in the center of the channel.
Who's that permit from?
From what we understand, that's part of, I mean, the EIR has details on trash removal. And I will say, I mean, I think there probably is some discussion about whether or not you can. So what can you go in and remove a diaper? Can you go in and remove something larger? And I'm sure in the back there are people who are arguing that point. I think that here's the concern. The concern is that bringing any kind of equipment into the river needs a permit. And so going in and pulling something out of the river with your hands might be different, but there is I will say on behalf of many of my members, there is a concern about going in and taking anything out of the river right now. I'd say they have concern about what that might mean, how that might affect it, whether it's permitted, and there's, I would say, almost a fear to do so.
So it sounds like maybe the diapers you don't need a permit, and the minivan you do. Okay.
Yep.
Second question.
Right,
looking at this photo, on the left-hand side of the photo, about the middle vertically, it looks like the kind of wandering thick white line is the sort of everybody else's levee, and the unless I'm mistaken, and kind of the edge of the flood channel. It looks like the farmer is farming kind of out into the middle of the river there. Do you see what I'm looking at there? I don't have the pointer, but does
I observe it? Yes.
So it actually looks like a bottleneck in the river there. Is that is that regulated? Because I'm trying to learn here. Is that farmer simply allowed to sort of put the levees where he or she chooses?
We know our property, and we know what the river does. And anyone that takes chances of doing things like that are taking the chance that can get flooded, or broken.
And maybe all their neighbors' land too.
Well, I would add that I think I would describe that as a farm at your own risk type of parcel, and I don't think that parcel is protected by the main or primary levee that would be protecting all the other blocks to what would be the left of that solid white line. But I think typically when you see those, they are subject to, you know, more frequent flooding. They're more minimally protected, and the parcels behind that, away from the river, are not depending on that levee
right
outside that one.
But it looks like it goes out to pretty close to the center of the river. So is that
no question?
So is that part of this whole permitting process that we're talking about, where levees can be placed, or is that pretty much up to the discretion of the farmer?
What I can answer for you there is, if I remember right, the operator of that property years ago had a mining permit and used that part for that. And what I understand, in the year 2012, he was not able to do that, hasn't been able to since 2008.
Thank you.
Mr. Young?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Abby, we're speaking different languages. I mean, to some degree. And my reaction to what I've heard just with this group, and, you know, I know all of you, I've lunched with you before, I really appreciate, you know, your energy and your passion, you know, for what you represent. I just want to describe my reaction to what I've heard and try to have us look at where we want to go with everything. Everything you've presented is in terms of how it benefits the landowner. Flood protection, flood protection, flood protection. The agency's charge on behalf of the public at large is to protect beneficial uses. We've got endangered species. And Wayne, I don't know if the steelhead habitat is better today
then without the dams and everything. You made that comment, and I'd have a hard time really believing that. Why are they threatened would be my question. You don't have to answer. Okay. But that's what I'm thinking. Why are they threatened? I'm concerned about that. Maybe we need an interpreter so that we can start speaking on a similar tone and understand each other. Abby, I think what we need is to model also the restoration, protection, and maintenance of the fish and wildlife habitat. I think we need to know, where is it at? What can we do in terms of non-native vegetation removal? And I'm all on board with that. Let's get rid of all the non-natives. I mean, that's a no-brainer, okay? But as we start to go beyond that, I would really want to know, okay, what do we need to do to at least to protect, you know, the other beneficial uses? So that's got to also be modeled. And so that before we start to engage in the long-term process, that we really know that it sounds like a hodgepodge of different short-term, medium-term projects are going to unfold. I don't know if they're all articulating together in unison. Sounds like there's a lot of moving pieces there. But I just want to make sure that they work towards the ultimate goal, which is also not to further degrade other beneficial uses. And I mean fish and wildlife habitat. So
I agree. And I think that's why we brought up the point that Dave did about the fish passage and the courses that he took, and really looking at the fish and wildlife data that they have and incorporating that into the model. Will there need to be more information gathered? Potentially. Is there a lot of information that we've had over a number of years that hasn't been necessarily incorporated into a model or peer-reviewed? I think there has. I think that the growers, you know, they've filled out 1,600 permits and did post-work assessments that maybe we haven't always taken into full account as we're looking at models. And I think that there's a role for us to do that. But to your point about mutual beneficial use, we agree. And I think that we need to look at beneficial use and how it pertains to agriculture, of course, how it pertains to fish passage, how it pertains to the marine sanctuary with the sediment and potentially the wastewater that's being pulled into it if there is a flood, how it pertains to people living near the river, you know, including growers, but just regular people in rural communities and people who work in farming. And I think that all of that does need to be looked at in that long-term approach, but also I think some of that can be and should be modeled in the short-term approach.
I agree with you. And to kind of paraphrase, I think what you've said, but I want to encourage it, is that you got to step back from your own perspective. You guys do a great job articulating the ag interest, but there's other interests there. And so you got to start trying to better implement those other interests into your plan. Otherwise, you're going to be just kind of butting your heads, and it's going to take more time and more time, and then we're really going to have another huge flood. So time's not on your side to really troubleshoot this, and I really would encourage you to start thinking kind of more globally about this. And Wayne, I just have to comment. Did you read the EPA and NOAA comment letters on the Intrex report?
No, I did not read the comments, but I read the Intrex report.
Okay. Please read those too. I mean, these are your permitting agencies.
But I have to answer your question, though. According to the World Book Encyclopedia, the steelhead thrive in cool, clear waters with a gravelly bottom where the current is strong and there are rapids and deep pools. And if you look at the river before the dams were built compared to how it is now, the creation that we have for them fits that definition better than before the dams were built.
Okay. I'm not going to argue with you as to what is in there.
We will hear from Fisheries and Wildlife and other agencies who can probably speak on behalf of a steelhead. But thank you.
Thank you.
Couple of inputs. One of them is on this slide. You know, some of the historical property boundaries used to be, well, my property is at the center of a creek. And so if you can move the center one way or the other, you push a little bit, couple of feet one year, then your neighbor push a couple of feet, and then you end up with some bottlenecks. So ultimately, somewhere along the line, there's a recorded deed that shows where the property line is. So I don't think it should be an issue of vagary of just, well, you know, that just happened to push the dirt a little bit more into the channel. The second, my last observation, and you know, we certainly will revisit this at the conclusion of a presentation. I wrote two words, private and voluntary. And I think private is one of the challenges because, as you indicated, all the land is privately owned. The other one is the program is voluntary. So it's really going to take, putting, and this is perhaps to parallel a little bit, or Emeritus Chair Young, input, it's going to really take a lot of collaborative effort because one of the concerns is the voluntary part. I'm not suggesting at all that it be done any other way, but if you do not have the buy-in of everyone, you're only strongest at your weakest link. And so I think it behooves really a lot of cooperative effort, and it's going to be cooperative effort with you and the growers that you represent, but also with the agency. So in the sake of time, I'll stop here. I'd like, if everybody is comfortable with this, and please bear with me, I would like to take a break now, a lunch break, and reconvene at 12:45 by the clock that's in the back. I know it doesn't give you a whole lot of time. Quarter to two. I apologize. I guess that was wishful thinking. It's done.